I'll read a few poems that are descriptions of flowers, just straightforward botanical descriptions. The first one is Honesty. This plant requires very little culture. If sown in a bed of common earth, soon after the seeds are ripe. It thrives best in partially shaded borders or in the wild garden in moderately rich soil. Scotch thistle. The juice of this medicinal plant is said to be good for a crick in the neck. Perhaps this is fortunate, for a flexible neck is needed when studying this grey-leaved giant, which may reach heights of 10 feet or more. With its mauve flowers, it makes a splendid summer windbreak. Bluebells. These delicately drooping flowers, swaying to the slightest breeze, are perennial and abundant on hilly pastures and heaths. The notes are an inconspicuous pale blue. Thrift. After the austerity of narrow leaves and tough rootstocks reaching among gravel, the mountain air allows itself an extravagance of pink blossoms. This one's called Sorrow. Apparently in some parts of, I think, the West Country, the plant sorrel is known as sorrow. Sorrow. A cooling plant of the fields and waysides, having something of the acidity of lemons. This isn't a flower. This one's called Pebbles. Place a few pebbles in a bowl of fruit. Their dull forms are restful beside ripe apples. Their smoothness is more inviting than the rinds of oranges. The reason I read these flower poems is because a continuing theme in all that I do is themes of wildflowers or gardens, and it's a kind of traditional theme running through English poetry that I've picked up and sort of made central and examined in some way. I'll read several garden poems to follow that. The first one is called The Garden, after a poem of the same name by Andrew Marvel. And in Marvel's poem, he talks about annihilating all that's made to a green thought in a green shade. And this is a sort of homage or a meditation on those lines. The Garden. Green thought, green shade. Blue thought, blue shade. Yellow thought, yellow shade. Red thought, red shade. Blue thought, green shade. Yellow thought, blue shade. Red thought, yellow shade. Green thought, red shade. Yellow thought, green shade. Red thought, blue shade. Green thought, yellow shade. Blue thought, red shade. Red thought, green shade. Green thought, blue shade. Blue thought, yellow shade. Yellow thought, red shade. Red thought, red shade. Yellow thought, yellow shade. Blue thought, blue shade. Green thought, green shade. It's another garden poem made up this time. It's a prose poem made up of found elements. That is, most of the sentences or phrases of the poem have been made up from various books on gardening. This is called Fragments of a Walled Garden. These still pools are not stagnant. A dragonfly flashes in the broken light. Deer may come down to drink. Great white clouds sail over the blue. The way to enjoy these things is to see them one by one. The forget-me-not on the water's edge. The yellow mimulus. The white spireas. The boat's nose touches the bank by a large clump of sweet sedge. One steps ashore among the heavy scent of bruised leaves. It is all so solemn, so dignified, that any fussiness of small detail, however lovely, would be a kind of desecration. The great cedars are still there, the wall seasoned and solidified by the years. Aubrietias and pinks hang in clusters. Snapdragon and thrift send their roots deep along the cool backs of stones. Even this would be monotonous, but for some areas of stone left almost blank. Long drifts of alpines are arranged in such a way that a journey through the garden, while it presents a balanced and dignified harmony, yet at every few steps provides a succession of small surprises. Everything falls into place, and a quiet progress is possible between the evergreen shrubs. There is no bewilderment, for there is no jumble of irrelevant items. Ascending the slope at every level, some new form of plant beauty is displayed. Formal restraint merges by degrees into freedom. There are seats at intervals, draped with cushions of wild thyme, providing rest and a wide vista across the lower levels. Where the stream divides, the path goes on, in a progression of varied incident, to lose itself among a small copse of alders, the advance guard of the forest beyond. The next piece is also a poem about a garden. This is called An Epicurean Garden, after Walter Pater. Walter Pater was a writer of the 1870s. One of his most famous books is called Marius the Epicurean, and this poem is made up of phrases, simple phrases taken from that book. Epicurus, the Greek philosopher, his disciples used to discuss philosophy walking about in his garden. And the idea was that a garden was a sort of suitable setting for philosophy, and that the surroundings would rub off on the thought and vice versa. And that's been a continuing theme in English poetry. And the poem plays about with that idea. My God. I've got visitors. An Epicurean Garden, after Walter Pater. Why don't we switch off? An Epicurean Garden. the oak of immemorial age, the rock fashioned by weather, the shadowy grove of ilex, the old wooden gods, the upright stone, the great portico, the dry paths, the scrupulous ways, the velvet of mosses, the young myrtles and flower, the distant fragrance, the clean lustral water, the last wreaths of morning mist, the sheep at pasture, the abandoned boat, the long summer day of idleness, the one level space of the horizon, the various sunshine, the pensive town, the solemn outline of dark hills, the urbanities, the graceful follies, the austere sky, the clear song of the blackbird, the ray of sunlight, the cool brown shadows, the hardness of stones, the chaplet of roses, the absolute transparency of air, the blue gentians, the drift of flowers, the allotted hours, the hoary roots and trunks, the abundant sound of water, the already mouldering travertine, the precious marbles, the dream of perfect music, the clear blue humours of the eye, the fragrant borders, the sepulchral inscriptions, the unseen violet, the wattled hedge roses, the natural wildness, the delicate sinuosities, the trace of some celestial wing, the ascetic gloom, the numerous cascades, the olive gardens, the little hollows and ravines, the placid spaces of evening. I'll leave one more garden poem, I think. This is a thing called Tansy Buttons, and it's a set of imitations of the style of Gertrude Stein. It's a favourite occupation among some contemporary poets to imitate Gertrude Stein. But these are done using and rearranging the words of another Gertrude called Gertrude Jekyll, who was a garden writer at the turn of the century. The idea being slightly that the two ladies would have, I think, had a lot in common that they met. Gertrude Stein was interested in gardens, but I don't know if Gertrude Jekyll was greatly interested in American writing. It's called Tansy Buttons because Gertrude Stein's most controversial text was called Tender Buttons. Tansy Buttons. One distinctly advises a kind of ordered informality. One distinctly advises ferns. One distinctly advises both native and exotic. One distinctly advises a dry wall. To know what to place where and when to stop. To know what it is well to let alone. Such discretion. In older days it was so, the picture complete in the still water, on summer evenings the shadow. A quiet progress just happened to come so, a unity presents no shock. It often comes of a want of space, and only a certain space is given. The path rises gently, doing something, and then passing to some other, thoroughly well and just sufficiently. Speak of a blue. It must have sun and air and full exposure. Its colour may be said to be blue, a neat, bushy blue. It will thrive and flower abundantly. It can never be repeated too often, that the very best effects are made with the simplest means. It can never be repeated too often. Confused and crowded is a fold, a chance patchwork. We paint with living plants and the simplest means. It can never be repeated too often. When the yuccas are in flower, the Ayrshire roses are delightful. Here is also tansy. It is a plant that will grow. It is a plant that makes a considerable show. Hard yellow flower. At the edge of pond or pool, here is also tansy. Asking oneself, why this and why that? Giving plenty of time to each little plant and asking oneself. Taking a light seat to the rock wall and giving plenty of time to each little plant. One had thought, then one sees. They open more and lie a little flatter. It is a good rule to make the steps so easy that one can run up and down them. Nothing is pleasanter than all the various ways. One is more than ever bound to the practice of the most severe restraint. Violet, iris, jasmine, and vine. Accept nothing that does not in its own place and way satisfy. Iris, poppy, jasmine, and vine. The serene contentment of an absolute. All the way down there would be the living water, rippling, rushing, falling. In little steps with falls, its rippling music. And in the same way throughout the garden, trifling, catching, guiding. Not a muddle of means that disposed might compose. I do not say it is easy. Any bare spaces can be filled with places whose presence is a comfort. The little garden is planted. This is a poem that's entirely a found poem. All the sentences were taken straight out of various manuals and teach yourself books on angling. And the poem is called Fly Patterns for Still Waters. The areas of clear water, once so unmistakably defined, have become obscured. Equipment has changed, but the basic traditional style remains intact. The weight of the catch will be in direct proportion to the amount of imagination, skill, and patience used. Extreme delicacy of presentation is essential in slow-moving waters. Use a bare hook of gold or silver and fish in a far-off style, taking advantage of any cover available. No elaborate float or paternoster is needed. All movements should be smooth and free from effort. The line should straighten in the air and the fly fall as gently as thistledown. Don't expect to conform to some fixed pattern of behaviour. An angler must be as versatile as the river he fishes. Use a wandering style of fishing rather than a static one. Hold the rod high against the sky so that the line may be seen against the afterglow of sunset. Try to think like a fish poised in clear water. Keep your shadow from the water. An unusual stir among the branches, a footfall on the bank, a dislodged stone falling into the stream will cause the fish to sink from sight. Use small flies in the bright hours and larger ones at dusk. A small, carefully adjusted float registers the most delicate bite. Throw away your hook after use.
Sarah Barker, poetry voice, Octon, October 1980. Well, I wanted to rebel against your poetry. But you said something last night. You said you didn't have anything to say as a poet, or rather as a person. And yet you were writing, so I wanted to know why you were writing, because in your poetry I didn't have any sense of you as a person, or your own very personal engagement with language. Uh-huh. And I just wondered why you started to write.
Why writing at all?
In the first place, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's easier to talk about these things sometimes in terms of another art. And the art that I always talk about, because it's the art that's even closer to me in a way than writing, is painting. And that question, why do you paint, is something that very few people would ever consider asking a painter. They just presume that he wants to make pleasing shapes, that he wants to make something outside of himself, which is some sort of authority. Yeah, I mean, the idea of what a painter does, essentially, I mean, there are exceptions, but it's an accepted practice in painting, that a painter wants to make a shape outside himself, which has its own authority and its own self-sufficiency, which has nothing to do with him. I mean, the standard case is somebody like Van Gogh, who everybody thinks of as being somebody who cut off his ear, and that fact is more essential than the painting. But nobody would ever dream of, say, a painter like Mondrian, of thinking, you know, going into his life and thinking who he slept with and why didn't he cut off his ear and so forth. Because the work is taken to be self-sufficient in itself. Now, the same thing's true, absolutely true of writing or any art, that as well as wanting to express something, one might also start from the idea of wanting to make a shape, from wanting to make something that's aesthetically pleasing. And so at the age when I started writing, I read a lot and wanted to be a writer, wanted to write. But what I wanted to do was not express myself. I didn't feel that I'd got something to say to the world. All I wanted to do was to make poems and make short stories and so forth. However, having done it for several years, I find that that initial feeling of wanting to make something deepens and becomes something else. It becomes an engagement with language, that you become fascinated by the things that language do, and you want, and you're simply curious about it. You're held by the intricacies of language, and that's what makes you go every day and work and write. It's not that, I mean, I don't go upstairs to my writing room and say, well, I've got such and such thoughts in my head. I've got certain themes that I'm working with, but they might be, like I was talking about the Ruskin piece that I did. A discipline might be that I'll be interested in John Ruskin, I'll have a page of his writing, and I'll use that as a sort of sounding board to get me started. And as the writing goes along, it takes a long time, but you become interested in what's happening in the language itself. And philosophically, the reason, the interesting thing about that is that if I set out to express my thoughts, that the writing would only contain as much authority and interest as I myself possess. But being interested in language, the writing potentially has all the interest and authority that language has. In other words, it's not just my possessions, the possession of the species, in a way. And so one's tapping something much faster than one's own resources in doing that.
Come back.
No, I can understand that, but I also think that in a sense that language doesn't come to life, although you can key in to a word or a phrase which has a long tradition and will suggest many things. I think, certainly I found in your poetry, it lost the dimension of... I mean, it's something to do with you.
there's no way...
I don't get the sense of your own context in that phrase.
Well, my own context in that is just the context of anybody within language. We all live. Language is our horizon.
But people don't use words arbitrarily.
Not at all, no.
It's with a sense of them and with a sense of what they want to communicate.
No, I would dispute that. I think that the vast majority of our conversation, the vast majority of it, is not something that of ourselves that we want to communicate. I mean, the fact is that most of our minds are a tissue of language clichés. And so it's not that we have some deep content to convey to other people. It's the fact that we ourselves are a tissue of what we've read in the paper, what has been said on the Melvyn Bragg program last night, and so forth and so on, all that we've learned. And one of the things about the business of writing is not that you've got something like that to express, but that you're attempting to free yourself from that. You're attempting to arrive at a point which is you, which will have some solidity. Do you see what I mean? I'm talking about the opposite sort of process from what you're saying. You take writing to be somebody starting from the point of view of personality or character or whatever that might be, and speaking with authority from that. What I'm saying is that as a person, I don't have that sort of authority, and I'm not claiming any personal failing here. I think that we're all in that position, but that authority and solidity is something that we arrive at. It's not something we begin from, and that's what writing's about. It's about, initially for me, it's about arriving at some sort of ideas that have interest and cogency or whatever. And hopefully for the reader, the same thing is true, that he can, through reading, see small little ideas that he hadn't quite perceived before, as well as be actually moved and have his emotions shifted around in the way that all good writing should do. Anybody else want to throw that open?
Well, first of all, that they all seem to have, if there is any rhythm, it's in the way you're speaking it, which I suppose is rather a paradox, but everything you read seemed to have the same rhythm. Maybe that's not part of what you're doing, and it's more engagement with phrases and with single words. But everything you read is the same. I just wonder whether you're experimenting with it, whether it makes sense at all.
Well, one's experimenting with rhythm in the sense that every poem's different. And I'm somewhat horrified when you say that they're all the same.
But that's the way you read it, possibly.
Yes, perhaps that's a failure in the reading. That may well be so. I read this morning a lot of prose poems, which I hope have got some sort of rhythm to them. But it's perhaps not as easy to pick up as, say, the Ruskett sketchbook, which I read last night, or the new book, which has got intricate rhymes inside it. And the sonnets, for instance, have got a sort of rhyme scheme cropping up occasionally. I mean, I'm not one of those poets who has studied rhythm as such and knows a great deal about it. I simply work, again, it's perhaps part of the way that I work, that I arrive at rhythm rather than starting from it. Usually, occasionally it's different. There are lots of short poems that have strict rhymes and meters and so forth. And something like the sonnets is an attempt to do something like that, to use a more or less traditional form. But I don't know how I can answer your question any fuller than that if the thing has sounded much the same.
Well, I wondered why you were reading them in the same way, that's all. And it's something that's that you consciously thought, that you wanted to achieve an effect by reading it in that way. Or is it something that actually comes at you from...
There's the great difficulty in reading to an audience, I find. Lots of poets are better at it than others. And my difficulty is that I always have a tendency towards attempting to entertain an audience. And if you're going to entertain an audience, you're going to have to attempt to get across the content of the poem. And that's a very dangerous situation, because I then attempt to stress words like, a lot of the poems are about the conjunction of an adjective and a noun, and I tend to stress that in lots of cases, so that rhythms of individual poems tend to get lost, particularly in the prose poems, where you sort of stress key words, and it's a tendency that I fight in myself, but I know it's there.
What was it you said about the haiku? Well, I missed that. I came in just when you... Because a lot of your poems, are sort of, or the very shorter ones, I think you read right at the beginning yesterday, but seem to work in the same way. Just very short juxtaposition of two phrases, not necessarily two images.
Yes. A lot of poetry all over the world has been about metaphor, about bringing two unusual things together. And if you think about it, that's, interestingly enough, what rhyme does very often. That the only reason for putting two things together in a poem is because they rhyme. And if you look at lots of traditional poetry, that is the case. And ultimately, all words are reducible to single things in themselves, which placed together can be seen as a sort of metaphor. And ultimately, that's what all poetry is doing. It's bringing together words that don't necessarily always in everyday language fit together. And the idea being that, again, as in all metaphor, when these two things are brought into conjunction, you will see each of them in some sort of fresh light. And exactly the same is true of words. That's in sticking two words together, you want to brighten both the words.
I wrote some down. I wanted to ask you. So, the abundant sound of water. And you used, I can't remember where it was now, but delightful, pleasanter, mm-hmm. words like that. Were they part of the phrases that you took from mm-hmm. you weren't trying to do anything?
Well,
because they didn't seem to come alive, because you just said they should come alive in a new way.
Yes. Well, the idea of that poem that you've quoted as the Epicurean Garden, and the idea that was to form a coherent whole, since they were all in Pater's book, Marius the Epicurean, they tend to suggest the sort of landscape that an Epicurean philosopher, or perhaps a decadent Epicurean philosopher of the 70s, would move in. And the idea of the poem is to make a sort of space, like a garden, in which the imagination could move about and pick up ideas and so forth. It wasn't in that poem so much to do with juxtapositions of adjectives and nouns or verbs or whatever, although that does come in phrases like the drift of flowers, the allotted hours, where you get a rhyme, and that's like a little surprise, because in the Gertrude, in one of the garden poems, I talk about how going around, should be a succession of small surprises, and that's what a garden is as well. It's some sort of delight for the eye. And so, really, one would say that in that poem, again, you could think of it as being like a painting, that it's something as you look around it, various things come to your attention. Usually they're in terms of ideas, like the mouldering travertine, so forth, which would suggest a certain kind of decay, and other things like the sepulchral inscriptions and the dry paths, the scrupulous ways, which would tend to suggest a sort of moral or ascetic setting for Epicureanism.
So you've actually keyed into all the other contexts and the things that word suggested before, so you've gone right back, really, I mean, almost in the kind of Chaucerian garden.
Yes. Well, I mean, once you pick up on the theme of a garden, you're absolutely committed to the whole history of English writing, because it's the central image, probably, in the tradition of English writing. I mean, that's one of the interests for me, is that I want to discover not only where I am now, but I can't do that without knowing where I've been and where the language has been. I don't see myself as being, although one's often described as an experimental poet, I don't see myself as being part of any avant-garde in the sense that I'm knocking down pedestals. I want to go one step forward, but I can only do that from a given position. It's like that proverb of the mountain that I used, to the mountain's stature add a single pebble. And that seems to me the only sort of realistic view that any writer can take. Nobody is original. And that sort of myth of the original genius, which is one that is again central to your expressionist theory of writing, is one that's not tenable.
But they are original in the sense in which they find their own forms and rhythms. I mean, that's I mean, they were using words that everyone's used for centuries mm-hmm. and centuries, but what makes them original is the order and the form that they give them and the rhythm that they give them.
Yes, but it seems to me that when we talk about originality or not originality, we're talking again in a historical context. And the fact is that for the past 100 years or so, since the Romantics, in fact, there's too much stress being placed on the idea of originality and not enough understanding of how much any man, however gifted, is tied into his own language and is tied into his history. I mean, that's a Marxist thought as much as anything else, that
you can't move out of your given historical context in that way.
Yeah, right. Can we come back to the cliché?
Yes, one always does.
Yes. You've just said that metaphor is putting two things together.
Yeah.
Maybe finding something
like
in the dissimilar. Would a definition of cliché be a dead metaphor?
Yes, perhaps. Or a definition of cliché would be any word in the English language you care to name. In the sense that the business of poetry is to make language new. And if you think about that, then all words are clichés. All words are things that we're used to handling every day without ever really looking at the shape of them or the content or the reverberations that they have. And one of the things that poetry does is to sort of hold them up to you and make you look at them a bit more carefully. And it can do that by attempting to unlock the sort of hidden resources of individual words, which are themselves clichés. I rather like clichés because I think that they, in fact, if you look at them carefully, contain a great deal of wisdom or truth or whatever it might be. And the fact that we've got used to it doesn't necessarily mean that it's invalid.
So are there times when you quite consciously decide to keep a cliché in a very clichéd form rather than...
Yes, I mean, the idea of your delightful such-and-such and pleasant such-and-such is, in fact, no writer in his right mind would actually sit down and write that. But the fact that one has found it and left it there has some significance, surely, because it has the significance that within a certain context of thought, there was something going on there. You found a cliché
I didn't know was one. Yes. it's in is it the third of the four sonnets, which comes in a series of lines where you're not simply writing clichés, but then one line, "May I be an island in the sea," which...
Yes, it's a sort of romantic cliché, that one, again, or a sort of Celtic mists cliché, that one, isn't it?
But the language you use there is it's using, yes. If Tom Pickard saw that line, I imagine he would cut out "in the sea" and say that "may I be an island" is enough. But the very fact that you use almost a redundant language there seems to be because you're, as it were, trying to tread very perilously close to...
Yes, indeed. There's a certain amount of overkill in it, in the sense that that particular poem is a piece of rhetoric. And it's not only a piece of rhetoric, it's a piece of conventional rhetoric. And if I can explain to you how that was written, it's in fact an imitation of a sort of genre of Celtic, early Celtic poetry, where there's a spell. In fact, there's a book called A Celtic Miscellany in Penguin, which is a translation of early Celtic poetry. And there's a spell there about yarrow, which says, "I will pick the smooth yarrow," that's in the first line. And it will do this for me, and it'll do that for me, and it'll do the next thing for me. But it's all written very conventionally, in the sense that the person who wrote it wasn't attempting to write poetry. They were not attempting to do something unusual with language in the way that I do. That was a form that I was interested in, so I picked it up and extended it and tried to do some other things with the form, but still using that very conventional rhetoric. Listen to anybody on any politician talking, they all use a certain language and they say or don't say things within it. And that's something also that one can do in poetry. is use conventions and try and make them
what
your
about
own.
People who haven't got the sense of poetic tradition. I mean, if you can look at this cumulative delightful presentancy, mm-hmm. trace it back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What does it do then?
Well, the trouble is that there is no common tradition anymore.
That's quite a specific literary context.
Yes. Yes. Well, there is no. I mean, the fact that one of the troubles of writing today is that the whole history of any writing is of any poetry is thick with allusion. Poetry is the most allusive art of any, and the trouble is with writing today that if one uses any allusion at all, there's very few folk are going to get it. Very few folk are going to pick up on it. So it's just a thing that one has to cope with. My writing is thick with quotation and allusion and so forth, and a few people pick up some of them. Some pick up more than others. But what's the alternative? You can't write as if there weren't any history. And it would be a very dangerous thing to write to what one would think of as one's audience's potentials, capabilities. That would be very dangerous indeed.
Well, I just think he's a very complicated artist. I mean, he does have this tremendous sense of history and tradition in his work, but when you read it, you are aware of that without having had to have read anything at all. One has that sense in the words and in the rhythms that he's used. He doesn't, I don't know if that's true, I just think he doesn't allude specifically, allude back into things very often.
I'm not quite sure what you're trying to say, other than the idea that I should write like Tom Pickard.
He's our hero, yes.
The thing is that poets are different in that respect, but as I say, my writing is thick with allusion, but that's something that interests me. That's what I like. I like in art, I like to have things referred to. It seems to me one of the pleasures of art, of any art, is that, within painting, you have painters alluding to other painters by using a certain configuration of still lives or maybe something. And one of the pleasures of looking at paintings, you say, he's done something by, you know, somebody else. He's used that. And that's just a sort of little added delight. But I don't think that, however elusive it is, it's quite as difficult as you're making out, in the sense that lots of people do read my things and tell me that they enjoy them, and I've no reason to disbelieve them in that, without necessarily picking up all that the poem enjoys. The thing is that I've used the language of flowers a lot, and at an early stage when I was involved in that, I had the idea that I would like my poems in a way to function like flowers, and that is that the more they were about the place, the more they infiltrated your consciousness, as it were, and that they didn't yield up all their fragrance and all their configurations at one go. I like, again, like in painting, a good painting is one that will stand living with. And I think that the same is true of a good poem, or certainly of the kind of poetry that I enjoy. I don't like poetry that I can get all at once and exhaust too readily. So that's one of the reasons for allusion, that one can come back to it and pick up things that one hadn't seen before, and also as one continues to read, because all writing leads to other writing. One can then again come back and find other things. And that's what a tradition is, really, isn't it? It's the fact that we all know where we are. That's what tradition's all about. In the most brute sense, it's that we're English, white, Anglo-Saxon, pigs and so forth, or we might also be other things. And so, I mean, the most allusive poetry that's ever been written was written in Japan, is in fact haiku. I've got a little book which is over there of frog haiku, and that refers to a tradition of Japanese writing. The most famous haiku is written by Basho. It's Basho's frog haiku. So since Basho, there was a whole, it was a thing for haiku poets to do, to write a frog poem, which was like a homage to Basho, and did something new with a very, very limited theme. And a test of the poet's ingenuity was how much, whether or not he could do something new with this very basic, the mundane idea of a frog jumping into a pond. And the other thing I like about Japanese art is this sort of deliberate scaling down of intention. A lot too much, it seems to me, of our romantic heritage is to do with a sort of grandiose notions that poetry is about deep emotion and so forth. It may also be about a frog jumping into a pond, and why not? Ask me another.
Don't have a copyright on the
words. What I was going to say was coming back to something Sarah said earlier. She said your poetry was more real on the page because of the print and the layout and the pictures. To what extent? That makes it seem almost a sort of visual art, as well as... Mm-hmm. To what extent is sound itself important? I mean, do you see it as to be left as a written word? I mean, obviously you read your poetry, so when you're writing it, how much do you think of the sound, and how much do you think of people actually sitting reading it, or sitting and reading it aloud?
That's a good question. It differs from poem to poem. But again, those sonnet poems and some of the ones that have rhyme and so forth are more to do with sound than, say, the prose poems. But I think that unlike a poet like Basil Bunting, who thinks that poetry is all to do with sound, which I think is nonsense, but it's a sort of polemical point that Bunting makes, really, I totally accept that we live... or have lived, we're changing now, but we have lived for a very long time indeed within a written tradition. And I like to, it's unfashionable to do so, but I like to remember the gains of having a written tradition and the fact that things don't get lost and that it's possible to preserve knowledge and so forth. And also, the other thing about it is that on the page, it's possible to be much more dense and elusive and difficult than it is if one's simply writing for reading. Oh, God. It's Bob Cobbing. Because obviously, when having a book, you can come back and look at it again and you can read it any number of times. And that seems to me a great gain for poetry. I mean, if it were an entirely oral art, as it tends to become with, say, Bob, as Basil Bunting claims it is, although there's nobody more dense and elusive than Basil is, then I think that a lot of that compactness and richness would get lost. I think that, so that I would accept that I am a poet for the page, essentially. But hopefully, the monotonous rhythm apart, obviously one hopes in reading that that will be one way into one's work. The trouble about publishing things in the way that I do is that there aren't any outlets for them. So people don't see them, and if they do see them, it's only one or two little odd item, so they don't quite know what I'm getting on about. And if you present a reading, you can, over the space of an evening, hopefully make a sort of coherent statement that people can then go back to and read individual things and see how they relate to the whole. And that, again, hopefully enriches each individual piece. The visual thing is also very interesting in that because my wife draws and we collaborate, there's a sort of cross influence goes on, in that she tends now to draw in a different way from she used to, because she's illustrated my work, and I tend to write things very often that have imaginary drawings of hers in mind. And also we have started putting on exhibitions here and there. And that again ties in with my interest in painting, with the idea that the painting sits there and slowly seeps into your environment. This isn't all that revolutionary a departure. It used to be in the 18th century a common thing for poets to write short poems or phrases or legends or whatever to go on tombstones or on monuments or in garden furniture or whatever. And that is a tradition that is now very derided because it degenerated into this sort of home sweet home thing that everybody had and Victorians had in their walls. But nevertheless, at its height in sort of Augustan 18th century, it was in fact a fine tradition and great poets wrote for it. Pope wrote verses for gardens and so forth. And it's an interesting challenge in the sense that if words are going to be on a wall, framed, or in a gallery, they have to be fairly good in order to withstand that sort of looking at. And if they're too cliched in themselves, they tend not to work. It's a sort of very disciplined sort of language you have to use in that way. Does that answer?
You just said two slightly contradictory things, actually.
I'm sure I do. Sure I do all the time.
On the one hand, you want your poems to be, as it were, in cards or in some kind of visual art object which one can start to live with. Yeah. On the other hand, you would quite like to, would you have a collected works in which people could build up the familiarity with the densely written content?
Yeah. I don't think that that's necessarily contradictory, in the sense that although it might only be a phrase on a wall with a picture, it might be very dense indeed in its allusions. And also, I mean, no doubt if when Oxford University Press got on the phone and say, may we have your collected works, there'll be a certain amount of things that won't be able to give you in. But that doesn't necessarily mean a great deal. What is necessary is that each individual piece belongs to the work as a whole, rather than that it fit into a book or go on a card or be read even. And I think that the coherence is in the sort of general area that the work moves in, rather than in individual sorts of presentations.